So the topic for today is the third of the five faculties and the third of the five strengths, right? Third of the five hindrances and the third of the five faculties. And the third of the five hindrances is been called in English sometimes sloth and torpor. And maybe some of you occasionally use the word torpor. I don't know how often people I know use the word sloth. And I think of them probably, maybe they were more common English words in the late 1800s when the first translators were translating these things in England. Maybe, so it's a little bit maybe, I think of it as an archaic thing. And then in the course of the talk, I'll offer you some other possible translations that maybe modernize it a little bit. And then the third of the five faculties is mindfulness, which is the very practice we're doing here. And that's also a choice that late 18th century gentlemen in England decided to for translating sati. And it's well worth sometimes some of us kind of questioning a little bit the English translations. And we do that, sometimes we get the fuller meaning of these words perhaps, or a more range of how we can use it practically in our lives. The wonderful Vietnamese teacher who died recently, Thich Nhat Hanh, probably one of his most influential books that he published in English is called The Miracle of Mindfulness. He published it pretty early. And if mindfulness is a miracle, sloth and torpor is the anti-miracle. Or the non-miracle, anti-miracle. But I think sometimes that it isn't this, as much as mindfulness is a miracle, I think of the miracles of mindfulness, not just that mindfulness is a miracle, but mindfulness allows all kinds of miracles. It allows because mindfulness is like opening up the field of possibility. Much more is possible when we are more aware. Something about the nature of awareness that allows things to be known, to be seen, to be heard, to be understood, to be thought. There's more room, there's more thing happening. Certain states of mind are kind of claustrophobic and crowded and small, and we get narrowed and limited by them, and we don't see so much what's going on, and there's not as much room for all this, you know, what I consider miracles of our lives and our world to occur. And I feel like since the time I've started to practice, I've been amazed by the unexpected things that happen. And partly one of the reasons the unexpected wonderful things happen is that I was more available, I was more able to notice them happening. When I was younger, I think I wouldn't notice as much. And I had a little teeny example of this today when I drove back here this morning. I was in my car and having innocent enough thoughts, but I was kind of involved in my thoughts. I was paying attention to the traffic and driving safely, I think, but I was still, you know, limited to my whatever I was thinking. And then for some reason I looked a little bit up and kind of woke up and, oh, here I am. What is this here? How is it to be here? And I noticed this beautiful sunrise. Wow, look at that. And there was this kind of, above the East Bay Hills, was this all this orange. And then there was clouds, and then there was kind of an opening, and the cloud looked like eyelids, and the sun was kind of like this beautiful, bright eye looking down at me. And I said, wow, this is cool. So that was a miracle of sorts, a minor one perhaps. But it was a miracle that I woke up from my little revelry of thoughts, and I was available to see something beautiful and nice that was nice. It was more than nice. There was something about it that was nourishing for me. It was kind of soothing and nice that my thoughts were not going to. If I continued those trains of thought, I don't think I was going to be harmed by them, but they weren't going to be soothing or nourishing in the same way. So mindfulness makes us available for this life. Sloth and torpor narrow the possibilities because we're too shut down to notice, to see and be present what's going on. And I think of myself, I think of these words, sloth and torpor, as being more like lethargy and resistance. There's a kind of, it's part of the strategy of not being present. And there's plenty of times that people have strategies to avoid what's really happening here. And these five, the hindrances, are five strategies that are sometimes used to avoid really what's going on at the here and now. Sometimes people use desire to avoid the difficulties in life and difficulties in relationship, or just, trying to get something that soothes us or distracts us or ill will, hostility, hatred. It's sometimes used to deflect feeling the suffering, feeling the difficulty, the challenge that we feel ourselves, the discomfort we feel, to blame it outwards, get it angry outwards. And sloth and torpor, this restlessness, this lethargy and resistance, is a way of kind of also not being present for the difficulties. So not only are we not available so much for the miracles, the sunrises, but we're also not available for the things that are difficult. And why should we be? Because those are miracles too. One of the remarkable things that to be discovered through mindfulness practice is that kind of like everything is an expression of our life and has something to respect worthy about it. Everything is a conduit, everything is a door into what is beyond it or within it or a door to the fuller potential of what's possible here. And as, this idea that awakening beckons us in everything. I mean, that everything has a role for our awakening, for our freedom. To be present even for the difficulties. We don't even always know why we're having difficulties. One variety of sloth and torpor is the depression. And I feel very sad. I could almost get depressed by the fact that we have a culture that doesn't respect depression. That too often so many people are quick to take antidepressants. Doctors are so quick to prescribe it. So quick we think something is wrong, that I shouldn't be depressed, it's something wrong if I'm depressed. And sometimes, of course, people should take antidepressants. Sometimes, of course, there is something that is out of balance that needs to be brought into balance. But sometimes depression is the heart's process of healing, of growing, of finding its way through what's happening. And if we avoid the depression sometimes, then we're really shortchanging ourselves. To be sad, to be depressed, and kind of, sometimes it's like fallow time. Sometimes it's a time to pull back and be quiet and allow something deeper to unfold and move. The depression is only a part of a bigger process. And so how do we let that process unfold? And one of the ways we let the process unfold is this miracle of mindfulness, which again makes room for possibilities, makes room for something to unfold and move through us, and something that can't happen if we don't make the room for it. And there are all kinds of difficult emotional states that we go through. There's nothing wrong with us that they're there. This is the response to life and the challenges it has. Why would we assume that the heart's response, that the emotions and reacts, responses we have within, are somehow shouldn't be part of nature as well? And we can have that kind of respect for all this inner life if we have the miracle of mindfulness. We have this ability to attend to it, make space for it, and are available for the inner processing, the inner unfolding of it. What is dangerous, of course, some of our emotions are dangerous for other people. If we have hate, for example, we don't want to give the impression that we should respect it in such a way we can act on it. We respect it in that it is a symptom. It arises, a natural process for some people, a symptom of something deeper that needs attention. Sometimes it's a deep hurt and sadness and wound. Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's the desire for something that's misplaced. But to be quiet and still and open to something that maybe would normally be considered unacceptable, in this context of sitting quietly in mindfulness and being available for the heart's working, the heart knows, the heart can find its way. We can go deeper. We can open to these things with mindfulness, allow it to unfold. And then it goes deeper and deeper. And what if depression is a invitation to feel our sadness? And the sadness is what needs to have time. What if hatred is an invitation to feel how afraid we are or how hurt we feel? That also needs its time and place. What if our joy is something to open up to with mindfulness? Because maybe it's a messenger that it's okay to relax. It's okay to be here. So sloth and torpor is the same way. I could either bore you or horrify you with war stories, bloody war stories of my retreats where it was me against sloth and torpor. And there was a lot of blood, a lot of gore, none of it which came from the sloth and torpor. My success rate in fighting sloth and torpor was zero. With, you know, attacking it or fighting and struggling, it was pretty hard for me. And I learned slowly, I learned not to fight it, not to see it as a mistake, but to be more at ease with it and to bring mindfulness to it. Okay, this too. And sometimes it was hard because I could do it for a moment and then I would fall asleep. But then I would do it again and again. And what carries the day is not your success at being bright and clear and sharp. What carries the day is the sincerity of your practice, which means that you practice the best you can, sincerely. That's all that matters. And so one of the ways I learned this was I was doing my long retreats in Burma. So in the afternoon I got really tired, which is a little bit different than sloth and torpor, but they overlapped for me quite a bit. Partly because I had so much resistance and so much despair about being tired that it kind of morphed into sloth and torpor. So that's where the wars were going on, was in Burma. But eventually what I learned after many months of doing this, that if I just did the best I could in the afternoon and the evening, that then there was momentum maintained and continued, so that when I got up the next morning, the practice was still growing and unfolding. And then I could feel it kind of sometimes developed in the mornings till noon. And then I could feel the mindfulness slipping in the afternoon, but I tried my best. I learned just to be relaxed. Okay, this is how it is. After all, I think I got up at like 2:30, so it's not strange that someone gets sleepy, you know, in the afternoon. It took me a long time to realize that. I thought it was a personal failing. So I kind of learned to be present in sloth and torpor. And I learned that the sloth and torpor also had a quality of the inside. It was part and parcel of this beautiful, I'd say, kind of appropriate, wonderful desire to grow in this practice. And so when I learned to see, I'm trying in some inappropriate way, and I'm frustrated. Inappropriate, I'm trying to, you know, get some, to grow in the Dharma. That's what my heart's greatest wish was to do. And I got disappointed when it wouldn't work, and I got discouraged, and that brought this on, that added to the sleepiness and the sloth and the torpor. So I got to appreciate, but this desire. This was one surprise to me when I was practicing in Burma. I was surprised that it finally dawned on me that this desire to grow in the Dharma was the heart's wish. I'd kind of come to believe, because of what I was told by all kinds of spiritual teachers, that I wasn't supposed to have any desire. Like especially the desire for awakening or something, that must be selfish. But I came to see, that's the heart's desire. It's not my desire. It's the heart's unfolding. And so I got to see the sloth and torpor was kind of a misdirection, misunderstanding. It rose out of something really beautiful. And I came to appreciate the beauty of this simple desire, which was kind of not personal exactly. It just felt like it was built into the system. I called it sometimes the biological imperative, the biological imperative to awakening. So I don't know if you care for that language, but there was a way of just felt like it wasn't personal, it wasn't mental, it wasn't planned, it wasn't, it just seemed like it just was built into this biological system. this movement towards freedom. Awakening beckons us in everything. So sloth and torpor. So partly it's, you know, things aren't comfortable, we don't like what's happening, and so we resist it. And one way to resist it is to give up, kind of in an unhealthy way, kind of get deflated, not make any more effort, you know, just kind of just dig in and, you know, become stubborn. And kind of get dull. It kind of, the mind gets dull, the mind gets cloudy, the body just feels lethargic, doesn't want to make any effort. As some of you know, I used to call this this my Sears mind, the Sears department store. And the reason for that was that when I was, I don't know, I was probably something like 11 years old or so. It was a few years there, 11, 10, 11, 12 years old, that my mother would take me to the Sears department store in Santa Monica, in L.A. And I just would go into that store, and it was like a recipe for sloth and torpor. I would just get so sleepy, and I was going in there to buy clothes, right? Oh, you know, I'm too tired for this. I don't know if I can do this. You know, no, do we have to be here? Or some of the mothers in here are collapsing. I'm sorry to. It's very, I should apologize to reminding you of how difficulty. Oh. And everything would be so heavy, and the smell of the store became negative association, and it was really tough. But you know, then at the end of the visit or something, my mother would say, "You want to go down the street and get ice cream?" It didn't take much to get me not tired, you know. Oh! You know, that's sloth and torpor was the strategy. I was like acting it out. I was just like, you know, I didn't want, there was clearly I didn't want to be there. I was didn't like it. And I was going to like just, you know. So I just, as I'm telling this, I remember there was one more time I went to Sears department store. I don't know if it was the Santa Monica one, but it was in that general area. And in that time, I stood outside the door before they opened the store with a big crowd of people. And when the doors opened, we made a mad dash through the aisles. And it, like it was a race to get to the ticket booth to get tickets for the Rolling Stones. I think I lost a shoe in the process. There was not much sloth and torpor. Maybe more like desire, right? And I didn't get it. I didn't get there in time. So, not one of the great tragedies of my life. But the closing store, that made an impact. So this and the resistance then, and the kind of the unhealthy giving up, being deflated, and so the question is, what is going on? To ask yourself, what's really happening here? What is it that what is it inside of us that would benefit from the mindfulness, benefit from this gift of attention? We're given this amazing gift, the ability to be aware, to be conscious, and we can apply this conscious awareness to all kinds of things. What would benefit from it here? What inside of us needs attention here? And sometimes it's our resistance. Sometimes it's our pushing things away. Sometimes it's our discouragement. Probably there's something. Maybe we are genuinely tired. And maybe our tiredness could use some tender, loving care with attention. Just hold it and be present. And one of the characteristics of mindfulness, so mindfulness is very simple awareness. In and of itself, mindfulness is like, I think of it as like the simplest capacity we have for being aware. And it's kind of a miracle to be conscious and aware. And being so simple, I mean, part of the art of learning mindfulness is learning how to find, tap into, how simple mindfulness can be. Because often we bring a lot of baggage with us as we're aware of things. Like when it comes along, our desires. I'm going to be mindful in order to have what I want to have happen. Or we want to get rid of something. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat down to meditate with mindfulness in order to make something go away. And it turns out that sometimes you can be successful. It works sometimes to do that. But actually, that did me a big disservice, because that just gave me more fuel, more to try more and more. And finally, when it didn't work anymore, that's when I started learning to be quieter and simpler with the awareness. There can be a lot of associations and memories that come with awareness, a lot of commentary. There can be, come along, some of the other piece of the baggage can be that I'm the doer of awareness. And anytime I'm the doer, I have to do it right. I have to be successful and I can't fail and so forth. So this doer. But it turns out in the simplest form of mindfulness, in a sense, there's no doer in there. It's just being aware. And there's no need for commentary. There's no baggage. No associated ideas of being for or against anything or desires. It's just this beautiful capacity to be present for things. To be aware. And so part of what we're slowly learning here is to help have this, the awareness be so simple. Just being aware. And see what happens. Be aware and see what happens in that field of awareness. See what unfolds. Freeing the mind from the attachments to what should happen, what shouldn't happen, what we want to see happen, what doesn't happen. And just be aware. Just be aware. It doesn't mean we don't have desires. The desires to be aware is a desire. The desire to be free of attachment is a desire. But, once you sit down to meditate, you should probably check them out, leave the desires out there in the hallway, in the foyer, put them on the shelf. Because they got you to the practice, but then don't carry them along all the time. It's just the baggage. All of you came probably with some kind of luggage, a suitcase or a backpack or something. You could just kind of just carry it with you everywhere you go on the retreat. Maybe bring to the hall, to the dining room, just bring it along, right? But, you leave them in your room or in your car or something. So the same thing, some of these healthy desires, they're appropriate, they serve for a purpose, but we also have to learn when to put them down, leave them in our room. They've done their job, and we've got to just be here so that then we can hear, keep relaxing into the simplicity of awareness. So I love the word awareness, and that's my favorite translation for sati rather than mindfulness. Partly because it suggests the simplicity, just being aware, just awareness. And partly because The word mindfulness, I think, often in English these days, I think too easily suggests something you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do mindfulness. Like my brother would say when I was, for good reason, when I was young, you know, Gail, be mindful what you do. As I walk the mud across the carpet. And mindfulness, and the way sati is taught by the Buddha, there's never a verb associated with it. It's not a verb, it's actually an adjective mostly. It's not a verb, it's not an activity you do, it's a state that you have. It's more like a state that you're in than a simple verb, what you do. And so some of the things associated with sati is to enter it, to abide in it, to establish it. I think those are the primary ones. And I think the word awareness, it kind of works better for those verbs. To establish awareness, to enter awareness, to abide in awareness, to rest in awareness. And so we bring this quality of attention to whatever is happening. We bring the practice of recognition, which is a practice we do, to recognize what's happening. We do the practice of feeling, which is kind of something we do in a sense, we feel. But the purpose for doing it is to bring us into what's happening, connected to what's happening in a clear and full enough way, so that awareness has a chance to fill it, to be present for it. So you can't be in a hurry. You can't be greedy. You can't be pushing for something which is, the qualities of it are closer to just being. It's very soft and open and allowing. Just this. But because awareness is so not an activity, sometimes we need a little activity to give it an anchor, to give it a little bit of weight or encouragement for presence. And the primary activities that help this awareness kind of stay present is the practice of recognition, which is sometimes mental noting or just kind of like, oh, there's the in-breath, the out-breath, there's a thought, there's a feeling, an emotion. And it isn't that the recognition is like the main thing we're doing, it's useful, but it's more like something saying to yourself, here, for this is where awareness can be, here with this. And so when I use mental noting, or I recognize what's happening, some clarity, it's kind of like I hear a sound, I might say hearing, and it isn't like I've done my duty at the end of hearing, like check that off, what's next? It's more like the note, the recognition is then followed by receiving that sensation of hearing more fully, just for a moment, like almost like the note is kind of like opening. So this is, what's this? What is this like? And then the hearing is what's important. So if there's pain, I'll note it as pain. And then, what is this like? Oh, it's like this. So I said, you know, if I'm with the breathing, I know and recognize the inhale as an inhale. But what is this inhale? So the awareness is open. The awareness is there to feel and sense in whatever way it comes. So the recognition is kind of like the tether or the anchor or the pointer for awareness here. So it's not unmoored too much. And then the other thing, so one thing the Buddha talks about is the actions associated with mindfulness is recognition. The other is to feel. So feel experientially in the body. Some people are more cognitive in mind, and so the recognition factor is their strength more than the feeling. Some people are more somatic, and the somatic doors is what works for them the most. And it isn't like one is better than the other, except for each of you. Each of you at different times, maybe even. And so at any given time, one of them might be more useful. Sometimes it's somatic is best for some people, best for some people sometimes. And so somatically feel and sense and be in the embodied experience. For other people, it might be that their thing is to know, to recognize. Ultimately, in Vipassana practice, both of them are very important, but at the deeper levels of Vipassana practice, it's the knowing faculty of the mind which carries the day, that keeps us in the field of awareness, keeps us in the presence of attention, of this open space. And so to be aware, so the Buddha refers to the four foundations of mindfulness, the four areas of cultivating awareness, as the ancestral homeland. I just love this idea that it's our homeland, our home, the place where we live. And he was then using that term. He used it in the context of where we're safe, where we're protected. So there's something about staying really present for our experience in the body and feelings and emotions, thoughts and all that, that protects us. We protect ourselves that way, partly because we're tracking, we're there and present in the moment, and we start learning when we pick up the strategies that end up harming ourselves or harming others. And we're right there, we can see, and then it isn't just right there to see it, but as we get quieter and more stronger in the mindfulness and awareness, we see that doing one thing is unhealthy, harmful, but simultaneously we see that another direction is better, we're better off. We see there's always a better alternative than doing something that's unhealthy or unwholesome. And this ability to, because we're so present and clear in awareness, to actually the whole system senses that this is an unhealthy direction, this is a healthy direction. And one of the healthy directions is this simplicity of mindfulness, simplicity of awareness. It's better than a lot of the alternatives than where we can go with the mind. It's fascinating to discover that it's better than thinking about the past a lot, no matter how good it is. It's also better than anticipating the future. And if being present mindfully is better than anticipating the future, what happens? What would you do in the moments that you're dying? Because in the moments you're dying, whenever that day comes, if you're not going into the future with the mind, not going into the past in the mind, if you're not going into the future even for a minute from now, when you're going to be dead, if the best alternative is just here, at the better alternative than thinking about where will I be reborn, or what are all my regrets are, or what will happen to my stamp collection. If you see there's a better alternative, and it turns out just to be aware, and that's so clear to you at your deathbed, how would you die? You would die protected. You'd die protected from a lot of unhealthy directions, things you could do with your mind at that time. And I just think it's a glorious, fantastic thing that maybe it's even the flowering of mindfulness to, at that juncture in your life, to realize the best thing you could do, the best alternative, that nothing better, I mean, you can't think of anything better to do, so why not be present fully for this experience now? So probably some of you know the Zen story of the man who falls off the cliff, but he grabs a branch halfway down. But then he noticed the branch is about to break. But then he sees on the wall of the cliff wild strawberry plant. So with his free hand, he takes the strawberry. Suppose that's a better alternative than when you have no other choice, the breath's breaking. Why not? So I don't know what you think of these ideas, but I'm trying to point you back to where? To here and now. The better alternative. So we see the better alternative, that this is not healthy, but maybe just being present for it is. With a kind of simple attention, which inadvertently, maybe, is deeply respectful of our life process, of this life of ours and its unfolding. It makes room for the heart to grow, it makes room for the heart to heal, it makes room for the emergence, for miracles, to make more possibilities. It's a wonderful thing. So I think of sati, mindfulness, awareness, not really as a practice. We practice in order to be aware, to be sati, but it's a state of just being alive with awareness. So someone says, you know, I don't like this, be mindful. They might be thinking of some, you know, some effortful practice technique that they associate with mindfulness. But for me, to say I don't like to be mindful is just about synonymous with being, you know, saying I don't want to be alive. I don't want to be aware. This is the, you know, this is the miracle that we are aware and here and now. And sloth and torpor diminishes that miracle. And it diminishes it, you know, the way we close down, shut down, it's often really bad things happen to us. I could write my biography, autobiography of my growing up. What doors in your heart closed? That would be the theme of that. I'd have all these stories to tell. There are sometimes I literally felt, okay, boom, I'm not going to share that ever again. Nope. I'm not going to open that way again, ever again. It was like, okay. And then, and some of it, you know, is very painful things. And then to open those doors is to go back to that pain. But the mindfulness, the awareness that's so gentle, so soft, so forgiving, so accepting, so making space for the healing, making space for the opening, making space for the growing. Whatever that this needs to be to unfold. And then slowly, learning to trust this awareness, which, as given what I just said, that trust being alive. It's no small thing to come to that trust. It's not easy. But what a great thing to be able to come to a place where we trust being alive. And it's not a sentimental trust, it's not a weak trust, it's not a kind of trust that makes us vulnerable. At some point, this third faculty, sati, mindfulness, awareness, becomes a strength. Each of the faculties becomes strong. And this is another part of the miracle of awareness, of mindfulness, is that there can be a strength with it. So we're this homeland that we're resting in or being in, we feel strong enough, we don't feel so easily threatened. We're protected. We're the elephant, not the ant. So may it be that as you sit here and practice here, that you consider how you're exploring the miracle of awareness. And you're allowing the awareness to open the field, open your heart, open what needs to happen. And that you come to trust being aware more than being closed. Being aware more than being reactive. You trust being aware more than you trust the hindrances. And if you trust awareness more than the hindrances, then you're in good shape. Because then when the hindrances come, which they will, you'll be aware of them. And that's what you're asked to do. Be aware.